Hello, and welcome to another edition of Njota Talks. Njota Talks bring you art, sharing richness. And I am Omenihu Amachi, your host today. My guest is a practicing physician and author. She was born in London to Nigerian parents, grew up and studied in Nigeria, London, and the United States. And she currently lives in the United States with her family. Her early work has touched on the Nigeria-Biafra War of the late 1960s and early 70s, a catastrophe that has been crucial in her memory, which also informs her work as an author. Dr. Achebe, welcome to Njota Talks.
Thank you for having me, Omenihu. Thank you.
You're welcome. Also in the studio is the producer of Njota Talks, Njota.org, Dr. Susanna Dodson. She's producing the program. Though she is behind the scenes and quiet, she's very much in the studio. And welcome our listeners to this program. You can listen in live or you can listen in later on the podcast. Dr. Ngozi, you grew up with a deep appreciation for books. Did this influence your desire to become an author in any way?
Well, I would say so. As most people know, if you look at my last name, which is Achebe, I am the niece of the great writer Chinua Achebe. And I always grew up around books. Because not only was Chinua Achebe a writer, I also had another uncle, John, who was a book agent for Heinemann, Thomas Nelson, Longmans. So the home was always full of books. Visiting either uncle was always an adventure in literature. And then, of course, my parents, they always introduced us to all kinds of reading. And my father, who is an engineer and therefore a scientist, also encouraged our reading. So we had a broad spectrum of education in the sciences and in the arts. So I was very fortunate indeed to have come from the family that I did come from.
Yes, you are very modest indeed. I say that because in searching your online postings, about yourself, I scarcely found a textual reference to your uncle, Chinua Achebe, who is a Nobel Prize winner. And I was wondering initially, were you the daughter or were you related in some way, you know? But you just made that clear now that he's your uncle. And I am sure that you learned a lot from him. What is a regular day between the two of you like in terms of your literary work?
Do you mean when I was young, growing up in
yes.
Nigeria? When
yes, how did,
you
how
know,
did he particularly influence you?
Well, yes, and let me tell you because it's such you know such an ironic thing is that the Nigerian Civil War is actually what. Made me grow up, live in, you know, around my uncle Chinua, because how it happened was we were all, you know, in different parts of Nigeria in 1966 when after the first coup happened in Nigeria and the killings of the Igbo people started, we had to come home. And all my uncles, including my dad, came back to my grandfather's house. My grandfather was the only person that had a house in the family. None of his sons had built houses at that time. So we all lived under one roof in my grandfather's house in Ogidi, which is in eastern Nigeria. And
yeah.
So I got to know my cousins. I got to know my uncles. I got to read a lot of books. We had a library there because one of my uncles, my uncle John, whom I had mentioned before, was around, you know, Gigi at that time, and he had a huge library there. So as the war was about to start was when my adventures in literature was about starting also. Even though I was quite young at the time, we were reading all sorts of children's books, you know, venturing into adult literature and those sorts of things. So that's how I came to really know my uncle very well, was those intervals during the war. And then after that, as each town fell and we went from city to city, he and my dad being particularly close in age meant that our families were also close in age. And we tended to go to the same cities. I mean, we went to Ezinifite, we went to Omar here, and, you know, lived very close by. So he was a big influence over me, I would say.
Yes, many people were influenced a lot by what happened during the war. Myself, I was I remember vividly a lot of the bombings, the air raids, the hardships that happened during that period. But I wanted to ask your book on NATO, which in my dialect,
yes,
I would suppose is on NATO.
Yes,
that,
yeah,
would mean a golden ring, a golden,
yeah, gold jewelry, yeah, yeah, golden jewelry or golden ornament, you know, or gold, or simply gold. Yes, yeah,
okay,
that's what her name means.
Yeah, which has a lot of significance in the Igbo culture, being that you named your book on Onedo, the blacksmith's daughter.
Yes.
Why did you choose that title?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A lot of people haven't asked me that question, but it's happenstance, really, especially the blacksmith's daughter. I thought about the blacksmith's daughter because when I started thinking about writing Onedo, let me step back a little bit more. When I was starting to research for my book for the Civil War, which is going to come out soon, it's called The Secret Keeper of Utopia, I came across an island called Sao Tome. Sao Tome, as you know, if you might remember from tales of the Biafran War, was an island, a Portuguese colonized island off the coast of Africa, that lots of people, goodwill people, Red Cross, Caritas, you know, all the joint church aid, decided to form a depot to ferry things into Biafra, which was then blockaded by the Nigerian forces at that time. Because tales and pictures of the Biafran children were beginning to filter out into the world, and people were looking at the whole scene, at the whole pictures, with absolute horror, and decided they were going to do something outside of, you know, the shenanigans that were going on between the governments. So anyway, I got to that point, and then I wondered about Sao Tome, the island, and when I started to investigate Sao Tome itself, I was really fascinated about its history, that it was a Portuguese, you know, outpost. It was a Portuguese sugar plantation. That was how it all started. And then I said, well, this is actually quite an interesting story. So I left the Civil War book that I was writing at the time and then started, you know, researching Sao Tome and Portuguese history in Sao Tome. So, you know, Onedo is actually a 400-500-year story that I am telling right now. And so that's how I came about going into Sao Tome and Onedo. And then I wanted to think about, you know, a slave, a girl that had been caught from Igbo land and went to Sao Tome. And I thought about, well, okay, such a girl would have a name such as Onedo, which means gold, a really precious girl, somebody that her parents would really be devastated to have lost. And that's why I thought about the name Onedo. And the blacksmith's daughter, when I was in high school in Nigeria, we were taught about the Iboku bronzes, if you remember. They were very exotic, very, you know, very lovely instruments of art that were also used, also had utilitarian uses, if you remember the discovery of the Moku bronzes. So I thought about a blacksmith that would have that skill set to have produced such exquisite things like the Moku art. And I thought, okay, I'm going to make that man Eneda, who is Onedo's father. And so that's how I came about Onedo, the blacksmith's daughter. And then I just happened to mention it to, you know, my cousins the other day that, you know, I came up with this name. And they said, well, have you forgotten that your grandmother was also a blacksmith's daughter from Oka? Your grandmother came from Oka and her father was a blacksmith. So, and you're named after her. Your name is Janet, you know, and I was like blown away, really, because I had forgotten completely that my great-grandfather was a blacksmith. So that's really, you know, the little anecdotal things why I chose that name.
Yes, it is indeed thought-provoking, but I'm struck with the multiple layers of interest and meaning that come up just in the title alone. Because as an artist myself, you know, my work as a painter usually carries narrative and multiple meanings. Sometimes
absolutely.
Not so obvious, but you know,
absolutely.
When you explain, you can
absolutely.
See it clearly. Yes, and so I wanted to look at the girl coming up of age in the Igbo society that is part of the character in Onedo.
Yes,
part of the book and
yes.
her tragedy. You know, without giving away the whole story. You know, tell us a little
yes.
bit more about that.
Oh yes, without giving away the whole story. Basically, she was a very favored child. You know, grew up and you know in Igbo land. And eventually found herself in Sao Tome, which, if you look at it now, it was actually the New World right off the coast of Africa. Because when you think about the New World and the Third Passage and all that about the slaves from Africa, you think, you know, they went over to America and they went over to, you know, South America and North America and all those places. But this was just off the coast of Africa. That was what fascinated me. It was a microcosm of Brazil off the coast of Africa. And so I decided to write, about this purely from a historical fiction point of view. If you grew up in Nigeria at all, you would know that when it comes to history, that we tend to start our history a lot from, you know, the British, at least the written history, from when we were colonized by Britain. We kind of seem to forget a lot about our Portuguese past. So I decided to go back that far, you know, because they were the first ones that actually came to our part of Africa. They were the first people that interacted with us, and I wanted to highlight that interaction because not all of it is what people think it is. There was more to it. There were a lot of intermarriages. There were exchange of ambassadors and things like that that happened before, the slavery now got into the game. So I wanted to highlight that part of it and show that this was an interaction between peoples that respected each other, at least to start with. And then,
yes.
you know, things happened along the way.
Yes, as in slavery, which is also another angle of the book. Many of our works reference slavery, which is another really bad thing that happened to our people, and the far-reaching effects of that continue till today. Does that can you add to how that influenced or affects the Igbo and your book?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot has been said about slavery. A lot has been written about slavery also. I don't claim to be an expert in it at all. I think that people are a lot more qualified than I to talk about that. But from this personal point of view, from the story of one girl, I actually wanted to give a different perspective to the usual sort of slavery books that we normally read. And so I decided to go really down into what was happening in Africa at that time, not the cliched, you know, people playing in the open field somewhere and then slave raiders come and take people away and stuff. I wanted to really go into what life was specifically, you know, how people grew up, how people had aunts. She had a very strong aunt called Aku, who was a midwife also, and a seer of sorts. Brothers that loved them without giving away, you know, other things, other relationships that she had. You know, she loved, you know, she lost. And all sorts of things that would happen to a teenager today. And I wanted, you know, that extension into that period of time to show that, you know, she is us and we are her. And it's not so different. It's not as different as we might think that it was. So that was my angle in writing this. About your question about the impact of slavery on Igbo land and Africa as a whole, like I said, you know, a lot has been written about it, and you know, there are people more expert than I that can go into that in more detail.
Okay, very good. I'm just looking at the way you mentioned. The girl, Onebe,
and
her suffering, you know, in the book. But it is, I don't want you to give away the story, so I'll
just
cut off on that angle a little bit so that you don't have to do too much explaining of that. However, there's been a major shift in public consciousness in Nigeria since after the Biafra-Nigeria War, which affected the Igbos tremendously. Many people today are educated in Igbo land, and, you know, many people who experienced the Biafra-Nigeria War at all levels, people are increasingly knowledgeable about global events, human rights, education, civil rights, security issues. Do you think that the Nigerian leadership is impacted enough by the recent strike, the Occupy Nigeria, to imagine the seriousness and the consequences of what is going on today in terms of the fuel subsidy crisis?
Do I think that the Nigerian government has done enough? Is that the question?
Yes. Do you think that they are doing the right thing? In other words, in taking away the fuel subsidy and then in bringing some of it back?
Well, as you know, the fuel subsidy question in Nigeria is a very complex one. The need for the fuel subsidy itself wouldn't be there if government was working. The biggest problem that the Nigerian government has at this point is the entrenched corruption that has pervaded all aspects of government functioning. And the second thing is security. As you know, there has been a terrorist infiltration into northern Nigeria. And, you know, disproportionately again, southern Igbo Christians are being killed. And all these things are going on at the same time as the government decided to remove the subsidized fuel that the average Nigerian gets. that's about the only thing that most Nigerians get from government is cheap fuel. And as you know, fuel in Nigeria is not just a question of driving your car and transportation. There is no power in Nigeria. Therefore, all the businesses that I know, the hairdresser down the street, the tailor, the shoemaker, wants to work his machine, he has to buy himself a generator, which is fueled by petrol. So removing the subsidy and the price of petrol going up is not just a question of transportation, in as much as it's important, you know, as an aspect of how a fuel is utilized. It affects all aspects of life. So I think why people were upset about it, even though if you look at it intellectually, the fuel subsidy itself is really subsidizing more of, you know, the corrupt practices, the corrupt cartels, oil cartels that ship oil into Nigeria. They are the ones that are being subsidized. But the average man on the street is also being subsidized. So that's why people got upset. It's not just, you know, it's not just because people don't understand that we cannot go on for too long with this kind of subsidy, but the fact that the reason why the subsidy is there in the first place, the corruption that has pervaded all aspects of Nigerian life, nobody is doing anything about it. Or if they are, they're just tinkering around the edges. So that's the complex problem about subsidy and subsidy removal.
Yeah, the president, Jonathan, in a recent speech, said that it has become clear that other interests beyond the deregulation policy have hijacked the protest to promote, you know, discord, anarchy, and insecurity. How do you view that comment?
Well, you know, I don't know about that. You know, whenever there is upheaval like that, there are always people that come out to hijack, you know, legitimate concerns of legitimate people. So that's always an aspect of Occupy movements everywhere. But what the Nigerian people would like to see is a determined, position by the government, by President Jonathan and all his ministries to really go after the root cause of the problem, which are the people that control this oil business in Nigeria and are really gaming the system. That's what Nigerians want. Nobody wants, you know, collapse of law and order anywhere. Well, nobody's advocating that. But the problem is that people, you know, are very angry. And when people are angry, they do all kinds of things. And not only about the fuel subsidy, but also the security problem, you know. And, I mean, I don't know whether the story is true or not, but apparently they caught the head of lead of this terrorist organization in Nigeria, like yesterday, and then they kind of let him escape. It's unconscionable, and it's just, you know, just ridiculous, actually, for that kind of thing to be happening. So there are a lot of things that are happening that need to be fixed.
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to let our guests, our listeners know that you are listening to Njota Talks. Njota Talks, a program of art bearing witness. I am Omenihu Amachi, your host. And today on Njota Talks, my guest is Dr. Ngozi Achebe, who is a practicing physician and an author, lives in the United States with her family, and is practicing. And she has written a book called Onedo, the Blacksmith's Daughter, which we have been talking about on this edition of Njota Talks. Njota Talks is produced by Dr. Susanna Dotson, who is the publisher of Njota.org. And again, I am Omenihu Amachi. You can listen to a podcast of this program directly after this live broadcast. You can tune in whenever you are free and listen to it as much as you want. Njota Talks is the program that you're listening to. I am an artist myself. I am a fine artist, a painter.
Yes.
I paint in oil.
I've seen your paint.
Those are my
yes.
choice because I do know how to use other media like watercolor and you know all the other different kinds because I'm a trained artist. Even
yes.
though I started painting when I was a little boy, probably my recollection at about 7 years old, I was drawing and painting forms that looked exactly. I remember my sister, my younger sister, I made a painting
yes.
of her at that age, and everybody
really?
Was amazed that I could do that. And I was amazed myself because I was just doodling, and I really didn't imagine that it would look like her. Yes. And so as an artist, I tend to be emotional about
yes.
the work that I do. And I,
yes.
even though I use brushes and different, sometimes I even use my hands if I
yes.
need to. You know,
yes.
doing the drips and the drops, the splashes, I do those also, depending on how I feel. And I find it amazing that our people, the Igbo in
yes.
particular, but Nigerian as a whole, do not really appreciate, if I may use that strong word, art that much as is done in other parts of the world. I don't know if that has anything to do with the view of or the name of it as Nkoriaka, which means art for clay.
Yes, I think you hit the nail right on the head. We really don't do art for art's sake. Art for us, especially let me talk about the evils that I know, is really functional. If we, you know, carve things and it's to appease, you know, one god or the other. We do decorate stuff too. I mean, we do have artists that decorate buildings and do those kinds of things. I do know that people paint paintings and hang them on their walls. They will make the paintings on their walls after they have sort of renovated the walls, if you see what I mean. So I think that's where that comes from. And once that utilitarian use is no longer there, it's abandoned, you know. We do have carvers, masquerades, as you know, if you go to the village, you know, if you went to the village as a kid and that kind of thing. So we have our own different kind of art. We don't have the art that you kind of hang on and just look at. Even if you have art on walls, it's part of the wall. It's not a different painting that you can take from the wall and put someplace else. So I think that's the difference. It's just the way that we look at art is totally different. For us, it's a function. It does something. And for these other cultures that you talk about, it's purely decorative, you know, because if you remember the Iwoku bronzes, most of the ornaments in Iwoku were ceremonial. They were beautiful and everything, but they were ceremonial. They were containers for something. They were fly whisks. They were, you know, spoons and machetes, highly decorated. The rope pot, the iconic rope pot. You know, so they were all used for something, but they were made beautiful even as they were being used for something. But things have changed, of course. You know, we are all westernized now, and I have paintings hanging on my wall, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I think people are, you know, people appreciate the art that you can also just look at for the sake of art.
Oh, yes. 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 Okay. I'm looking again at your education, which we started talking about briefly at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You are a physician, a medical doctor.
Yes, I am.
And you were trained in both Nigeria and London, and here in the United States also.
Yes.
That training, in any way, altered or affected your life?
Well, I kind of always wanted to be a doctor, being the child of a nurse. I was always surrounded also by medical books, which absolutely fascinated me. And being a doctor felt right for me also. So I always kind of struggled with both sides of my brain, you know, the doctor side and the art side. And I, you know, went with the doctor side initially. And, you know, have practiced as a physician for quite a few years now. And while I was doing that, I'm afraid I kind of neglected my art side. And I'm just beginning to get back into it. And, I mean, I've always written, but not as, you know, passionately as I probably could have. So I'm happy now that having satisfied my doctor side, I'm now going into my art side and my literature side, and hopefully I will do it as well as I can for the time that I have.
Yeah, and this is one of the issues I was alluding to earlier, talking about art. Traditionally, also our people, the Igbo, gravitate or encourage us to go toward, to take a career in medicine, more so, or as an attorney, more so than as an artist. Even though we had those functional artistic careers that were, were supported by...
I understand exactly what you're saying, because as you know, it happened in my family with my uncle Chinua and my grandfather. If you know anything about him, that he started off as being a medical student. He was very bright, and he was given a scholarship to go into medicine at University of Ibadan. And he did that for a little while and said, you know, this is not me. I'm supposed to be an artist, and so I'm going to pursue my art. And so he dropped out of medicine at Ibadan and went into classics. And I mean, the rest, as we, the rest is history. And medicine's loss became literature's biggest gain, I think, and I think a lot of people think. So,
I like to toot my artistic horn every now and then when I can, because when I look at a lot of the buildings you talked about earlier on, beautiful, magnificent buildings carved out by architects and and even golden and bronze sculptures, you know, that are made, and all that. Artists do shape society and do promote positive well-being of the people. And
absolutely.
As a writer yourself, as an author, as a person who promotes comprehensive reform, do you think that artists in Nigeria or in Igbo land are doing enough to help guide or steer the society or the populace to have better lifestyle.
Yeah. I think so. I think, you know, artists do what they can do. Artists have been the conscience of any society, and Nigeria has been no different. I mean, you know, the great Olusegun Inca as well, you know, Chinua Achebe, Obiora Udechukwu, all those people have great voices of conscience for our country, and so they do absolutely play a very big role in the life, you know, of our people and of all people, you know, especially in Africa. You know, artists are special because a lot of things go on in our society that need being thought about. So I don't think you need to toot your horn at all. I will toot it for you. And tell you how important our artists have always been, and will continue to be.
Yes, that's refreshing to hear from a fellow artist, because as an author, you are an artist. And,
well, thank you. That's a big compliment right there.
Where can people get your book? Or how can people get your book? Hello?
Say that again.
Yeah, I was asking how people can get your book.
It's Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon.com. You know, Barnes & Noble. In England, it's, this is an American program. So anyway, in England, W.H. Smith also.
Yes, go. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, you're saying that people can buy it from Barnes & Noble.
Yes, Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com are the two places, you know, that you can get it.
Do you have any other Biafra stories that you would like to tell us?
Well, my book, The Secret Keeper of Utopia, will be coming out pretty soon, and you know, I will. But I can tell you anecdotes. You also were a child in Biafra, I understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
You were? Okay. And you know, you know that, you know, we had children at that time had a lot of trauma. You were always thinking about death. You were always thinking about where your next food was going to come from. But most importantly, you were always thinking about losing your parents, because you knew that if they were gone, you were totally, you know, on your own. Totally. So, you know, all those stresses are things that we as children went through at that time. I remember, you know, the one about food. I remember me and my sisters asking my dad once, you know, oh gosh, when are we going to ever eat rice again? And he said, well, when the war is over. And we laughed and laughed, you know, very skeptically, and said, really? Yeah, right. You know, when the war is over. We just thought it was never going to end, and this was what life was going to be. So, you know, those are the things that we went through at that time that I'm sure you know about. So.
Oh, yes. I actually used one of those memories in one of my paintings called Mother Feeding the Biafran Children.
Mother and Child. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because my mother was in the Red Cross during that war.
Oh, she was.
The cornmeal and the
salt,
formula too. They brought that to her, and she had to take some young women and go into the bushes and the farms and get cassava leaves, which they boiled.
Oh, yes. The formula two, the egg yolk.
But when I think back at those things, and I'm sure that you do too, those periods, and you see what is going on today in Nigeria, especially with the bombing of the Igbo. You know, after all that war that we had in the late 60s and early 70s, today there's bombing and killing of indiscriminately of Nigeria, of Igbos in the north.
Yes.
And I don't know how much is being done about this. How much response are the Igbo are we taking this too lightly? In your mind?
I don't think we're taking it lightly at all. I think after the experiences of the Civil War, at least there's a generation of Igbos that are pretty cautious about how they approach things. There are also young Igbos now that have very little memory of the war itself, but what they have learned about it since then. And they, of course, don't see any reason why they should continue to be marginalized in this country, which they call their own. So I don't really think, people are taking it lightly. I think it's just sort of something that's simmering there and needs to be addressed. And with time, we're just going to see how it happens. Going with this Boko Haram thing you're talking about, we happen to be the Nigerians that live the most outside of our homeland just because of who we are. And when these things happen, they seem to happen disproportionately to us. And the Nigerian government at this time claims to be doing something about it, and apparently are. Like I mentioned before, the guy that was caught and then kind of led to escape doesn't really give much confidence in, how the security is working out at this time. But we will watch and see, because we will always want to give people a chance to do what they say that they're going to do. So that's really what I can say about that.
Yes. Okay. The you were talking about the mastermind who bombed the churches where Christians were praying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I Christmas
believe they put a name out there. Karibu Sokoto was the name that I read about, and he was arrested near Abuja, the state capital. And then they said he had actually lodged in one of the governors, the governor of that state.
I heard that.
In the government house there, and he was arrested, and then.
I was absolutely horrified. A governor?
What I read this evening indicated that the president, Goodluck Jonathan, had issued an order to the Inspector General of Police to recapture him immediately, or he would lose his job. Did you hear that?
And the guy that's harboring him, that harbored him. What happened to him?
They arrested everybody in that governor's lodge. So there's a lot going on as we speak.
Yes, it's very fluid. Very fluid, yes. Like I said, we always want to give a person a chance.
President himself, Jonathan, is doing the right thing, and that if he is, people should.
I hope so too. I hope so. Absolutely.
He will be getting the support. Do you think he should be getting more support?
Is he getting more support? It's too early to tell. Remember, it's just 48 hours after the strike on the subsidy thing was called off. And if people see that he's really determined, you know, to root out corruption and also provide security, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't be supported. After all, those are the things that he ran on. Those are the things that people turned out massively to vote for him on. So if those things are seen to be done, especially the corruption part, that is, you know, people are there that are going to be, you know, open to investigation and giving a clear account of what happened, I don't see any reason why, you know, Nigerians will not support him, you know. So that's, like I said, it's early days yet. And if he continues in this manner, then yes, he's going to get a lot of support, because it means he's listening to the people and he's doing the right thing. So, but like I said, it's just a question of wait and see before anybody can get a, you know, resounding endorsement.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right about that. I was thinking we had Dr. Okendive on our show last 2 weeks ago. You know him, right?
Absolutely.
He's also one voice that resounds in making his voice known about current.
Absolutely, about what is up. Yes, I have been following his statements, and he's a brave one, and making his voice heard. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he talked about his childhood days also, and you know, how that impacted him in doing what he does today.
Yes.
And so it appears that the Biafra experience really motivated or gives voice to a lot of what the Igbo are doing today. Do you think that our children, our upcoming children now, are mindful of those experiences? Are they getting the stories?
Well, it depends on, you know, the individuals. And my children know. My children know a lot of things about Biafra. They know about Ujuku. They know all the songs because I sing them. So it just depends on, you know, what you tell them. It's not in the history books, that I will tell you, because I had a cousin of mine that was in school in England, and with friends of hers that were Nigerians, non-Igbos, and when she was talking about the Civil War, some of them said that it never happened, that she wasn't telling the truth. So there has been a systematic covering of the Civil War, of not addressing it. And I understand why. You know, that wasn't Nigeria's finest hour at all. So I understand why, you know, people will not want to talk about it per se. But it is part of our history. And as painful as it is, it needs to be talked about. So I'm thinking that, you know, we're going through the phase now where more people are talking about it, at least in a way that maybe non-accusatory, just a way of understanding. But the problem that I see actually with the Nigerian situation, especially with the Igbos, is that the Igbos still feel marginalized, and for good reason. And, you know, if they continue to feel that way, any discussions that you're going to have about the Civil War is not going to be one that will be very productive. Because, you know, if you're still talking to people that are upset and angry, or their children are angry for them, you know, in the end, that anger is going to boil over. And so that's why I think, and I've always said, that the genocide, because that's what I call it, of the Igbos, is Nigeria's original sin. And until that is really dealt with, it's going to be really difficult. it's going to be really difficult, and I do not see that it has really been dealt with. There has been no truth and reconciliation like you have in South Africa. I think that's what would have, you know, that's what will or would have been a great, you know, way to go forward. But I don't think all hope should be lost yet. I think, there's a lot of way to go.
That is why I lament over what is really going on, because a commentary, an independent commentary that I read was that, you know, the Northerners are killing the Igbos. If you look at what just happened with the escape of the arrested terrorists, and then you look at the strikes that have happened. The strikes happened, and the labor unions called out everybody, the masses, to come out and protest. But the killing of the Igbos and Christians in general, nobody called out anybody to protest, and people didn't really make their voices loud enough. You know, and that's where people are starting to have issues. Is this deliberate?
Yes, yes. Well, yeah, I mean, I would hate to tar everybody with the same brush, because I have great friends from the North. I mean, I hate to use that cliche, too. You know, like, those people that tell you I have, you know, a lot of black friends and stuff like that. So I wouldn't want to do that. However, yes, I understand, you know, why people would be angry and upset to come out and occupy for fuel subsidy when nobody came out to occupy for people dying. You know, fuel subsidy is not more important than the lives of our people. However, those things in my mind are intertwined. They all come from, you know, the corruption and the lack of security. If there is no corruption in Nigeria, it will be very difficult for people like Boko Haram, that group, to take a hold. If people had electricity and water and stuff like that and, you know, had a job, it would be very difficult to, you know, get people to do that, to get people to be angry enough to go out and, you know, start killing people and doing all the things that they're doing. That is not to say that there are no bad people amongst us. There will always be the, you know, bad and evil ones amongst us. But the fact that they are able to go in there and get all these people, you know, to follow them and do all these things that they are doing is an indictment. You know,
right.
It's an indictment of the society itself. You know, and not just, you know, the rest of Nigeria, even the North, you know, because there are a lot of poor people there also. You know, they're not all benefiting from this so-called, you know, Nigerian goods and riches. They're not all. So it's a complex situation which needs to be dealt with, you know, with a lot of courage, because it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. The people that are being dealt with are very strong and entrenched in what they're doing. So it will take a lot for President Jonathan. It will take a lot of courage on his part and the part of his ministers to do the things that need to be done.
Absolutely. Do you think he's getting support from outside? Good counsel?
Who? President?
Yes.
Do I think he's getting enough support? And good counsel?
Good counsel, yes.
Outside of Nigeria?
Yes.
Or in Nigeria?
In Nigeria. It's an abstract question.
Well, in Nigeria, I mean, yeah. I'm sure he is. You know, I'm sure he has a lot of people, you know, that are giving him good advice, but there are also people that are giving him advice based on their self-interest, you know? And that's always going to be like that. It's up to you as the wise leader to, you know, to figure it out, basically. At the end of the day, people give in their inputs, and it's up to you to tie it up together and make the decision, the buck stops with you. Or the buck stops with him.
What about pressure, international pressure? Do you think he's getting a lot of international pressure?
To do what?
To make the kind of decisions he's making, like the oil subsidy removal.
To remove the oil subsidy, is he getting? I think that the IMF wants the oil subsidy removed. Absolutely. I mean, why wouldn't they? You know. But at the end of the day, like I told you earlier, the oil subsidy situation is a complex situation. Even though we, as the common man, we are benefiting, or the common man in the street is benefiting from the oil subsidy, there are people also that have hijacked the oil subsidy for their own good. So it's a double-edged sword for us. But on the other hand, that's about the only thing where, you know, the man in the street is getting from the government. And so it's kind of difficult to, you know, tell people that you're removing this, you're going to double their expenditure, and it's all going to be good for them. It's difficult.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult, and without removing the pillars of the corruption, of what is actually at the basis of all this, these people that are hijacking the subsidy are doing it because people are not going after them to, you know, stop them from doing it. I was reading today in the papers that the port authority in Nigeria doesn't know how many ships coming. He said he doesn't know because he had been told to look the other way when ships come into berth. The mother ship stays out there and the little ships come and offload from it. But there's no documentation because he was told by some minister, you know, not to do it. And that was all out today in the news. I was actually reading it before this interview started. So there's a lot that is wrong.
There's a lot that is wrong. And in the meantime, a city like Aba has deplorable roads. There's no light, no electricity, running water that sustains the people for months and years on end.
I don't know any city that has water and light like that, except maybe Abuja and Lagos. You know, Enugu is the same, you know.
Well, I'm hoping that this situation that has erupted in Nigeria will be a catalyst for change, for
absolutely
change, life.
Yes, absolutely. But I don't think it's going to be business as usual. I really don't think so.
I hope not. Mm-hmm. But for my teenage daughter. Mm-hmm. And her friends and relatives, you know, the youth in Nigeria, as an author, looking back at those library books, those books in your collection over the years, would you have a list that you would recommend just off the top of your head for?
Would
for
I have a list of books? They should read Zara, The Wind Talker by Nnedi Okorafor, and also Who Fears Death. Those are the two sort of youth lit that I just read, and I was absolutely blown away. She's such a talented writer. About the 419 situation, if you want a humorous way of looking at it, you can read I Do Not Come to You by Chance by Trisha Mulbany. That was Adobe Trisha Mulbany. That was a great book also. So those are the ones I just read. Of course, you know, there are others that have been out there for a while. Those three, I would say, for a teenage girl, go and get it and read. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ngozi Achebe, for my guest today, for my listeners, my guest today has been Dr. Ngozi Achebe, who is a practicing physician and the author of
Onedo, the blacksmith's Onedo, daughter.
The blacksmith's daughter. The blacksmith. That title always.
Yeah, that's the title. Onedo, the blacksmith's daughter.
Yes. If like you said earlier, just the historic and cultural relevance of the blacksmith's daughter and the blacksmith himself, who is an artist, who works in gold, and all the gold that has been, you know, taken away from the continent over the years, and much of that gold today is in a lot of museums around the world.
Absolutely.
That is happening in Nigeria today. So I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ngozi Achebe, for
being
my guest today on Njata Talks. I hope that you will come again and talk with us on something, some other issue.
Absolutely. When my new book is out, The Secret Keeper of Utopia, I will be honored to be back and talk about it at that time. And hopefully things in Nigeria will be much better.
We'll look forward to that.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I want to thank our listeners for listening in today to Njata Talks. I am Omenihu Amachi, your host, and in the studio is the producer, Dr. Susanna Johnson, and who is the publisher of Njata.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Njata Talks, and you can also listen to the podcast of today's program with Dr. Ngozi Achebe. Look up my artwork on the Njata Talk site. Look up on drsusanna.org and look up on my online gallery, www.nyaxe.com/Omenihu Amachi. And if you are willing, if you are touched by any of the artwork that you see there, don't hesitate to give me a call and we'll negotiate. Thank you very much and have a good evening.
Thank you. Good night.